Hello, and welcome to the Thinking Elixir podcast, where we cover the news of the community and learn from each other. My name is Mark Erickson.
And I'm David Bernheisel.
Let's jump into the news. First up, Jose Valim opened a new PR on the Elixir 119 development front. So we'd already heard the news that development focus was now shifting to 119 in 2025, just in early part of January, right? So the exciting part is the title of this PR is Turn Type Inference Up to 1000. And it's fun because he explains what this means. He says, prior to this PR, we performed type inference only in patterns. This pull request adds type inference to most expressions in Elixir, including function calls, paving the way for us to add inference of guards. And he gives a little code example. You can check out the PR yourself. We got a link to it in the notes. But he says the best way to show this is with an example. So it's a very simple example. So I'm just going to try and understand this little code snippet. You have a function called def add foobar, and it receives an x. And the body of the function is just x.foo plus x.bar. So he says we can automatically infer that that x, the argument being passed in, is a map which has at least the foo and bar keys, where their values must be integers or floats in order to have the plus operator apply to them. So the return type is either an integer or float. So that can all just be inferred from that little bit of code. That's really neat, right? It's like I don't have to decorate anything to say, yeah. Oh, this is an integer or a float, or it could be either. It's just, that's cool.
Yeah, that's going to be exciting. I presume that also works for structs, because it's just a fancy map at that point.
Yeah, but that's without declaring and doing a pattern match to say this is this struct that's being passed.
Exactly. Yeah, there's been some complaints, or not, I don't know if complaints is the right word, but folks do notice that, like, if I want stronger compile warnings, mm-hmm. I have to essentially alias all my structs everywhere, and I just don't want to do that. I don't want to do that because for fear of dependency compile time kind of dependencies, and you end up getting into weird cyclic patterns and stuff, and it can hurt compile times essentially.
Interesting. Yeah,
maybe some of that's true. Maybe it depends on how you're doing it, but I think just pattern wise, like code convention wise, I think generally people will just pattern match on the shape of things more often than being stricter with, like, oh, it has to be this struct coming in. I don't really care about the shape. Because I care that it's that type, that struct rather. And then if it's that struct, then I don't need to care about the shape. The shape, really, like the pattern matching part, is really just a convenience now to, like, auto assign variables coming in.
Yeah.
You know, depending on how many you're doing and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, this is going to be interesting. I'm kind of curious of where this is going to land, like, code convention wise. Like,
right.
Yeah. Is it going to drive more people into aliasing or less people into aliasing all their structs?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll find out. We'll see.
Letting it be more vague. Right.
Right.
Yeah, because, like, it'll catch it for me.
Yeah.
Half the time I put in those struct in my pattern match because when I come back to that function later, I don't want to have to figure out and think about and, like, look at the references to say what's coming into this.
Right. Yeah. I think I lean that way. Like, I want to be more explicit with, like, I expect only this type to come in. And then I assume that the compiler is going to help me out.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to add to that, on the PR, Jose further noted that there are about 10 to-dos he has to tackle before this gets merged. So, this is the beginning of that work, but that's really cool. And there's also some additional fun discussion in the PR. We're asking about how deep does this type inference go? Like, if you have additional function calls within that function body, does it keep going all the way down? Jose hints that there can possibly be done more in the 119 release. Yeah, so it's not going all the way down on everything yet, but it's still super exciting, and this is a great way to start off 2025.
Hip hip hooray! Better types, yay! Fireworks, all right. Okay, well, hey, speaking of newer elixirs, since we're talking about 119, which is just the development, that's main right now, it's the main branch right now, so no one's going to be practically using it unless you're really looking into this stuff. But the latest really released one tagged version, I guess, is 1.18. And so if you're into editors with LSPs, which is probably most of us, you're probably interested in knowing that Elixir LS was updated to support Elixir 1.18. So if you're have a team of devs that you're working with, and you want to make sure the development environment for everybody's working out okay, you'll probably want to bump Elixir to 1.18. But before you do, if you're a good team lead or whatnot, you probably want to make sure that everyone's LSPs can still work. And so the good news is that now, yes, it can. Elixir LS, the most popular one, is updated to version 0.26, which supports Elixir 1.18. That's the only thing in the change log, but maybe there's something else sneaking in there. I don't know. Maybe just a maintenance release to keep things going while they're working on the new LSP LS server called Expert. So I don't have any details on Expert, but I know that everyone's looking forward to it. We'll see. So in the meantime, go update your Elixir LS, go update to Elixir 1.18, and you'll be smooth sailing.
Yeah, and that release is really kind of split across two different projects. It's the Elixir LS changelog is there, but then there's also the VS Code Elixir LS. I think if you're using the VS Code plugin, it'll automatically update your Elixir LS. I'm not 100% sure on that, but it seems to be the way it goes. But yeah, if you're using other environments, not VS Code, then maybe you have to be a little bit more explicit with those updates. And next up, there's a new library that I thought was pretty interesting. So have you ever needed to execute JavaScript commands from your Elixir server? And I don't mean like Phoenix pushing down to the client, like in a, push this event. I don't mean like that. This is like, I want to run JavaScript code from Elixir on the server. And that's what Andreas Lundahl wanted to do. So he created a project called Deno Writer. So Deno, if you're not familiar with that, it is a JavaScript runtime that's become quite popular for being able to run and embed things. And this is actually a hex project that takes the Deno runtime and puts it into your Elixir application. It loads it in through a Rust crate called Deno Runtime, and then it uses Rustler to hook that in as a NIF, a natively implemented function. So it's like loading in, it's leveraging what's already there with Rust, brings in Deno. So now you can execute JavaScript commands directly from your Elixir code. My obvious next question is, why would I want to do that? Who needs to do this? Andreas needed a way to run server-side rendering of a Clojure script app, and it would work equally well to do something like a React server-side rendering, right? Like running that explicitly from Elixir. There's another use case that kind of came to mind. It's like, oh, well, what if I have that situation where I have some process that I want to run? You know, this could be like a batch job or a cron kind of thing. I just do this periodically, and there's this process I need to run, and there's this one step in the process that there's already a JavaScript library that does this. And so what are my alternatives? Like, well, I could re-implement that functionality in Elixir. I don't really want to do that. I could put that whole process into JavaScript and let it be that way. But it's like, well, I lose a lot of the benefits I have of Elixir, maybe some of the integrations with my app. I could create as a separate service and make calls to it. Well, then that's something I have to have an API for and manage another service. Or something a lot of people do is they will just shell out to run a node command and execute this JavaScript that way. Well, what this allows you to do, what Deno Writer lets you do, is it can run it as a supervised service, as a supervised process in your Elixir application, and let you be able to talk directly to it and execute commands. Or you can even just do them as one-offs and not have it be supervised like that. An example of this is there's a library called Cortex.js. And it is a TypeScript library for symbolic computing and numeric evaluation of mathematical expressions. So
rolls right off the tongue.
Yes. So that's Cortex.js. So it's like, oh, I already want to use this library. It does what I need, but I don't want to like run that on the client side in a browser. It doesn't need to be there. I need it on the server. So like this gives you a way to do something like that. I just thought that was really cool. And hey, if that's a problem you have and you're like, I know that I would like to be able to run some JavaScript from my Elixir server, you might want to check out Deno Writer. Got a link to the GitHub project and the Elixir forum post where it was announced.
Yeah, that's all really interesting. The first thing that comes to mind is, they gave Cortex.js as an example. It's probably a very complex example that does a lot of work in JavaScript. And so, yeah, Deno is just the runtime. It's just like Node, right? But just it's just a different version of that that includes a little bit more, kind of like bun. Bun includes even more. It's a package or two, I think, right? But denim, I think, is a little less than bun. Doesn't matter. Anyway, it's just an execution environment. I'm a little iffy on making it a NIF. I mean, it makes sense, but I'm a little iffy on making it a NIF because that means like, well, does that mean that some JavaScript weird error
could crash your whole server?
Well, I mean, I guess not like my JavaScript dumbness, you know, will crash the whole server, but like, yeah. I guess some weird thing in the execution environment, you know, goes belly up, like that could crash the VM at that point. Versus a port, you know, if you're shelling out to to Dino, then it doesn't really affect your VM. I'm not saying this is a bad idea. I'm saying it's pretty interesting because, yeah, that does kind of enable a lot of stuff. It's like, okay, one of the complaints a lot of folks have about Elixir is like the ecosystem. There may not be like a package for your niche that you're trying to solve, but the Ruby environment's got a gem, maybe a little old. Maybe more, maybe not. Maybe it's just good. So they'll compare that and like, no, I guess I'll just go with Ruby then. It's got everything I need. Yeah. The same thing on the Elixir on the front end side. But the front end side has generally been like, oh, it's only in the client. But in the past year or two, they've made more headway into being more of a server side, a full stack kind of platform. And so you got hosts like the Vercel and others, you know, that kind of have like a first class way of supporting server side render JavaScript that then the front end JavaScript will then like kind of hydrate with more state, you know, on top of that. And so it becomes this whole, it becomes, well, full stack, like we're like a lot of Rubyists are used to with Rails. And so all that to say is JavaScript obviously has a lot of packages out there to do, well, kind of probably whatever you need. So image transformations is usually a thing that I see on JavaScript library. So you could, in theory, like it says here for Cortex, you just shell out to some node server, a server node CLI kind of thing, right? And get your result right then and there, which is really, really kind of fantastic. I kind of want to see this. Isaac Yanomoto did a great job with Ziggler. And I know Wrestler is like a lot of that as well, but with Ziggler, you could have like the Z sigil and have your Zig code in there. Yeah. I kind of want to see
some JavaScript code. Yeah, just
yeah, like
that
a like the... a tilde J or something. Like that's JavaScript, tilde JavaScript. Be long, but yeah, I want to see that. Like that's compiled now into my Elixir application, and I just execute it in this Deno writer, you know, runtime. Which, for what it's worth, I don't see like a pool. This is not pool managed, so you might want to consider a pool of available runtime, you know, Deno writer runtimes, I guess. Yeah, and then have your JavaScript code just kind of be executed in the available Deno environment that's in your application supervision tree. This is just mind blowing how much you can do here. I went long there, but this is pretty cool. I'm curious how this will evolve.
They talk about having heterogeneous environments. It's like when you start mixing languages within languages. It's like, what is that called? I don't even know.
Yeah, this is pretty neat. All right. Well, hey, moving on. Speaking of heterogeneous, you know, environments running a bunch of stuff, a different approach to this is a different language on top of the Erlang VM. But it's still the Erlang VM, I guess. Well, sometimes. So there's Gleam. Gleam's right out there. And Gleam 1.7 was released. Speaking of JavaScript, just by the way, Gleam also compiles to JavaScript. So pretty cool. Gleam is also type safe. It's scalable for the same reasons Erlang is scalable. But it also compiles over to JavaScript runtimes. So we've got a link to the news post where they talk about it. It's just highlighting a couple of items from it. It's faster record updates. So updating a record, which is like a struct in Elixir. Record, for what it's worth, I think is the Erlang term for what things could look like over there. But it now monomorphizes the updates, meaning it generates exactly the most efficient code to construct the new record on a case-by-case basis, removing the runtime conditional logic that it's associated cost entirely. So that's pretty cool. Nice optimization, computer science kind of stuff. Yeah. Also, the generate decoder code action, Gleam has a very robust type system, and it won't let you unsafely cast values between the different types. So a drawback of this sounds of the sound type system is that converting untyped input from the outside world into data of known types does require some additional code that would not be required in an untyped system. So imagine all of your controllers, you know, in your web layers. So the decoder feature is a language server feature that when you hover over a type, it can auto-generate the decoder code needed to parse it from something like JSON from the front end. So it can help generate all that boilerplate code. Speaking of which, any TypeScript developer knows this too. you have to, it's so annoying sometimes, but that's the nature of type-safe languages. You have to declare your types, so that's one thing. And then you have to declare the types coming in to your function so that it can cast to that thing. And then you're probably yanking out some keys out of that as well and defining what their types are. So it's just types everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I got to say, like, when I was working at this one company and there was a whole group, like division of the company, it was all Java. Right. Our services would integrate with theirs. We had Ruby and Rails and we had Elixir. And a breaking change for them was even adding something new because they had the strongly typed Java code. And I think it was auto-generated from JSON or something like that. But it was brittle. And it would just, if you added something new to it, it'd like blow up. I can't interpret this. It's like, oh my gosh, that's terrible. And now I hope Java has gotten better since then. That's years ago. But it's like, that was like one of those things like, how can you put up with this?
Why is this your life? All right. Well, there's a lot more in the release around packaging and documentation. Gleam is actually really great in that regard. It's kind of an all-inclusive thing. The LSP is in there, for example. So it's a lot more in the release, but that's Gleam 1.7. You should go check out the news post on it. We got the link in our show notes.
Yeah, and I did just want to mention my little dig against Java does not apply to Gleam. The auto-generated code for the decoder function, you can tell it's more only looking for the pieces of data that it cares about. So it's like, it's all good. All right, and next up, Gleam related. Louis Pilfold shared that since the version 1.0 release of Gleam, his role has actually shifted from coding to leadership. And there's a contributor named Jack who has been the one really keeping Gleam improving at the rapid pace that they've been doing. And he's been doing it entirely without pay. And Jack is now has it set up for GitHub sponsors. So if you're using Gleam, certainly want to consider supporting Jack to help further the Gleam work. We were just talking about Gleam 1.7. And I hadn't realized that Louis had shifted, you know, around the 1.0 timeframe. As the environment, the ecosystem grew, the community grew, there were more people able to contribute and you need someone to kind of organize and approve and all that. So that's been more of his focus. So that's just interesting to learn too.
Yeah. All right. Also, a blog article caught my eye. It's a short blog post too. The article is about Google Maps auto completion techniques in Phoenix and Phoenix Live View in particular. It's actually a two-part article, so we'll have a link to both. The part two is pretty interesting though. I've actually done this before, so it's interesting to see somebody else write about it. I should have written about it when I did it a long time ago. but here's the short version of it. And if any of this, you know, interests you, we got a link to those blog posts, so it's a good one to read up on. But here's the short version of the process, right? So the goal is you have some form and in it is some address and you want to help the user out. Like typical web interactions, you know, you go to Google Maps and you start typing something and it auto completes for you. So if you want that experience in your Live View application, this in particular is still using the Google API, but I imagine it would apply to any similar APIs, other mapping systems, that kind of thing would work just as well. So here's the short version is that you would have a Live View form, normal, and in it you would have a search input. So a little text box, right? You type in it for the address autocomplete. So this is where you put in address. You have the people start typing. So it's a Live View process, Live View form that by default will just send all those form change events back to your Live View process. So you'll get that address that they're starting to type in. You would have your Elixir application have a little API wrapper around the Google API. There's lots of hex packages around that too, for what it's worth. You query their API. So this is in your backend at this point. So it's nice and secure and safe. And through your network, not through the client's network. So you've got your query going to the Google API, response back with all the predictions, and then you just feed those predictions right back into your live view process with all of those predictions, I guess. And so your typical live view rendered, you know, output would auto update the output on the client side with all those predictions. And there's a lot more details in the blog post. You know, there's more events to worry about. You have to select one at that point. You know, that's just to populate the drop down of options. But what if they select one? There's probably other kinds of data that you want on that, not just a big string, but maybe a big map of all the parts of the address, that kind of thing. Addressing and geospatial kind of stuff can get quite heavy, depending on what you need out of that. So good blog post. We got a link out in our show notes for that.
And last up, last week we talked about or shared the announcement of the new Gotmeier conference, and we were just having fun with the name of it. But coming back to the Gotmeier conference, there was a little bit more news. So Sasha Yurick shared that he will be speaking at the Gotmeier conference. So he says, my third and possibly final speaking gig of 25 will be at Gotmeier. Looking forward to hanging out, exchanging ideas, and exploring the lovely city of Varberg. So as a reminder, the conference is on the 10th through the 12th, starting off with a Nerves Conf first day. It's in Varberg, Sweden, and it's 2 days of the Elixir side of the conference, the pure Elixir, like not just Nerves, and it's single track. That's exciting. So we'd also reported before that Sasha Yurick had said, you know, he needed to step back from the amount of engagements he was speaking at. So sounds like maybe three, and this would be the final one. So, hey, if you want to hear Sasha Yurick speak and you'd love to check out the beautiful country of Sweden in September, that would be the conference to go to. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us next time on Thinking Elixir.